Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Welcome back. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Today we have two interesting stories that will help you learn American English. The first is about how language in our country may change in the near future. Then some science news about the odd connection between a rainforest and a desert. If you are ready, let's get started with part one. Experts say the city of Los Angeles is showing the future of language in the U.S. More than half of young people there speak at least two languages fluently. By the end of the century, most Americans will not come from white English-speaking families. For more, we turn to Jill Robbins.
In the U.S., speaking more than one language fluently is not very common, except in Los Angeles, California. The city has one of the largest populations in the U.S. of young people between the ages of 18 and 34. This generation is often called millennials. More than half of millennials in Los Angeles are bilingual, which means they speak more than one language. Maria Elena Burgos is cooking a Mexican breakfast. She says making Mexican food is just one of the many traditions in her home. Another is speaking Spanish to her children.
We want them to be bilingual. We want to keep the Spanish somewhere in their learning too, not only at home.
When Ms. Burgos first came to the United States from Mexico, she learned English. She knew her children would learn English quickly, so she wanted them to speak Spanish at home and study the language at school. She says being bilingual will give them more opportunities in the future. Knowing Spanish also means the children can talk with their relatives in Mexico and El Salvador.
When we had our children, one of the decisions we as parents decided was to name them with a name that was easily pronounced in English and Spanish.
Her children include daughters Elizabeth and Monica. They like speaking both English and Spanish. Elizabeth wants to know her family's culture.
The culture, to go back to our roots, because that's part of who we are.
Monica wants to pass on the culture to her children.
It's nice to know our culture and then be able to pass it on to our children and grandchildren and everyone, to let them know where we come from.
And Monica says she does not speak only English and Spanish. She has even learned some Korean in school. The U.S. Census Bureau says more than half the adults in the Los Angeles area, between 18 and 34 years old, speak a language other than English at home. For the whole country, the number of bilingual adults is only 25%. The number of bilingual speakers has gone up since the 1990s. At the same time, the number of foreign-born millennials has gone down. In other words, more people in the U.S. are learning a second language at home or in school. Many immigrant parents are passing their native languages to their American-born children, says University of California, Los Angeles, Professor Raul Hinojosa. Mr. Hinojosa says that in the past, the children and grandchildren of immigrants did not continue to speak the parents' native language. But now, the opposite is true. In the last 10 years, more immigrant parents say they want their children to keep speaking their native language. Mr. Hinojosa calls their choice the path of pride.
Mandarin is going to be encouraged. Japanese is going to be encouraged. Vietnamese is going to be encouraged.
Raul Hinojosa says the decision to keep a native language is clear in Los Angeles now. And as the number of minorities in the U.S. continues to grow, he thinks bilingualism will spread to the rest of the country. I'm Jill Robbins.
You are listening to VOA, and we are coming to you from Washington. Scientists say the world's largest desert and the world's largest rainforest are connected. How is this possible? The scientists believe the answer is a transoceanic stream of dust. Marcia James has this report.
Large clouds of dust blowing off the Sahara Desert can easily be seen from space. Joseph Prospero is with the University of Miami in the United States. He has studied African dust for many years.
Atmospheric dust, African dust, is one of the most prominent atmospheric features, second only to clouds.
In the 1970s, Joseph Prospero found that a large amount of dust can blow all the way across the Atlantic Ocean. He spoke to VOA by Skype.
We knew there was a lot of dust. I mean, it's obvious there's a lot of dust when it rains in Barbados or even here in Miami during the summer months, you actually get a layer of mud in the bottom of the bucket.
African dust storms can harm air quality across the ocean. But new research shows the storms also can do some good. Scientists observed Saharan dust by satellite as it blew across the Atlantic. Hong Bin Yu is an atmospheric scientist at the University of Maryland. He found that an average of 28 million metric tons falls in South America's Amazon River basin each year.
Yeah, it's surprising because of a huge amount of dust and phosphorus.
Phosphorus is a nutrient that plants need to grow. Hong Bin Yu found that the Amazon receives about 22,000 metric tons of Saharan dust each year. He says the dust is an important provider of fertilizer.
The soil has a limited phosphorus, and it also can be washed out by rain and flooding.
In fact, the phosphorus falling from the sky is about the same as the amount that rivers carry out each year. The thick rainforest and the desert dust are joined together on one small planet. I'm Marcia James.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. This is VOA, the voice of America. Once again, we remind you of a way to get the most out of this free Learning English program. Get your hands on a computer and download and save the audio as a podcast. Then print the words you just heard in these two stories. Now, read along and listen to the program again. Try saying the words the way we do. Start slowly at first with just one sentence, then try two or three sentences. Before long, if you practice every day, you will be speaking English the American way. Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. Chinese officials have predicted lower economic growth again this year. They say that huge government spending programs are coming to a close. Instead, officials say they are seeking what they call higher quality but more modest growth. The goal is to increase domestic consumption and grow the economy in a more balanced way. Last week, Chinese Premier Li Keqiang reinforced this opinion when he announced a target growth rate of 7% for 2015. That is well below the Chinese economy's average over the last 20 years. However, there are signs that the government has not yet ended its big spending programs. Li Keqiang announced a 13% increase in fixed asset investments, things like buildings and machinery. The premier also said there would be new spending in energy, railways, water management, and housing. In January, Li Keqiang promised to create 10 million new jobs in 2015. Partly through investment in building projects. The new spending program is less than the stimulus plan China put in place during the world financial crisis. In 2008, China announced a spending package of $570 billion. This year, however, Mr. Li has set aside $260 billion for spending in infrastructure and parts of the economy. The government is borrowing money to pay for new projects. Finance Minister Lo Jiwei said in a news conference that deficit spending will be about 2.7% of the gross domestic product. That is the value of all goods and services produced by the economy in 1 year. It is an increase over last year and almost as much as during the financial crisis year of 2009. China's debt has increased 4 times since 2007. The McKinsey Global Institute estimated in February that total debt in China was valued at 282% of the economy. That includes government, corporate, and household debt. The same report estimates U.S. debt to be 269% of GDP. China's Ministry of Finance had been limiting spending to cool the economy. But Mr. Shen says the finance ministry appears to be changing that policy. China's local governments hold large amounts of debt, and that has hurt their ability to invest in new infrastructure. Yinzhong Qing, Deputy Director of the Finance and Economic Committee of the National People's Congress, spoke to reporters recently. He said the central government would offer about $160 billion in low-interest bonds to replace existing debt owed by local governments. And that's the Economics Report from VOA Learning English. I'm Mario Ritter.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Theodore Roosevelt became President of the United States at the beginning of the 1900s. He firmly believed in expanding American power in the world. To do this, he wanted a strong navy, and he wanted a waterway that would let the Navy sail quickly between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. Roosevelt decided to build that waterway. This week in our series, Richard Rale and Morris Joyce tell the story of the Panama Canal.
For many years, people had dreamed of building a canal across Central America to link the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. The most likely place was at the thinnest point of land, Panama. Another possible place was to the north, Nicaragua. President Roosevelt appointed a committee to decide which place would be better. Engineers said it would cost less to complete a canal that had been started in the 1880s in Panama. But the United States would have to buy the land and building rights from a French company. The price was high, more than $100 million. So the committee decided it would be less costly overall to build a canal in Nicaragua. The proposal went to the United States Congress for approval.
The House of Representatives quickly passed a bill to build the Nicaragua Canal. Then the French company reduced its price for the land and building rights in Panama. It decided some money was better than no money at all. President Roosevelt was pleased. He gave his support to the Panama plan. When the Senate began debate, however, it appeared the Nicaragua plan would win. Then a volcano exploded in the Caribbean area. A city was destroyed. 30,000 people were killed. Soon, reports said another volcano had become active and was threatening a town. The volcano was in Nicaragua. Nicaragua's president denied there were any active volcanoes in his country. But one of Nicaragua's postal stamps showed a picture of an exploding volcano. That little stamp weakened support for the Nicaragua Canal. The Senate passed a bill for a Panama Canal instead. The House of Representatives changed its earlier decision. It approved the Senate bill.
At that time, Panama was a state of Colombia. Canal negotiations between America and Colombia did not go smoothly. After 9 months, the United States threatened to end the talks and begin negotiations with Nicaragua. The threat worked. In January 1903, Colombia signed a treaty to permit the United States to build the Panama Canal. The treaty gave the United States a canal zone. This was a piece of land 10 kilometers wide across Panama. The United States could use the canal zone for 100 years. In exchange, it would pay Colombia $10 million plus $250,000 a year. The United States Senate passed the treaty within 2 months. The Colombian Senate rejected it. The Colombian government demanded more money
President Roosevelt was furious. He saw the issue in terms of world politics, not simply Colombia's sovereignty. He said, "I do not think Colombia should be permitted to bar permanently one of the future highways of civilization." Roosevelt was ready to take over Panama to build the canal. That was not necessary. A revolt was being planned in Panama to gain independence from Colombia. The United States made no promises to support the rebels, but it wanted the rebels to succeed. Under an old treaty, Colombia had given the United States the right to prevent interference with travel across Panama. Now, the United States used the old treaty to prevent interference from Colombian troops. Several American warships were sent to Panama.
The local leader of the Panamanian revolt was Manuel Amador. Amador had the support of the French company that still owned the rights to build the Panama Canal. The chief representative of the company was Philippe Binovarilla. He worked closely with an American lawyer, William Cromwell. Binovarilla and Cromwell provided Manuel Amador with a Declaration of Independence, a constitution, and money. Amador used the money to buy the support of the Colombian military commander in Panama City, the capital. He also got the support of the governor, who agreed to let himself be arrested on the day of the revolt. Amador formed a small army of railroad workers and firefighters. The rebel army planned to take over Panama City on November 4, 1903. Just before that date, 500 Colombian soldiers landed at Colón, 80 kilometers away. The soldiers could not get to Panama City, however. All but one railroad car had been moved to the capital.
Manuel Amador gave a signal. The revolution began. There was a little shooting, but no one was hurt. Most of the shots were fired into the air to celebrate the call for Panama's independence. Colombian officials were arrested quickly. Then Amador made a speech. He said, "Yesterday we were slaves of Colombia. Today we are free. President Theodore Roosevelt has kept his word. Long live the Republic of Panama. Long live President Roosevelt." Colombia asked the United States to help it regain control of Panama. The United States refused. It said it would oppose any attempt by Colombia to send more forces there. The United States also recognized Panama's independence. And almost immediately, it started negotiations with the new government on a canal treaty.
The two sides reached agreement quickly. The treaty was almost the same as the one the Colombian Senate had rejected earlier. This time, however, the canal zone would be 16 kilometers wide instead of 10, and the United States would get permanent control of the canal zone. The treaty was signed on November 18, 1903. That was just 15 days after Panama declared its independence.
Colombia protested. It said the United States had acted illegally in Panama. Many American citizens protested, too. They called President Roosevelt a pirate. They said he had acted shamefully. Some members of Congress questioned the administration's deal with the French Canal Company in Panama. Several investigations examined the deal. Theodore Roosevelt did not care. He was proud of his success in getting the canal started. He said, "I took the canal zone and let Congress debate. And while the debate goes on, so does work on the canal."
It took 10 years for the United States to complete the Panama Canal. The first ship passed through it in August 1914. In that same year, the United States signed an agreement with Colombia. The agreement expressed America's regret for its part in the Panamanian Revolution, and it provided a payment of $25 million to Colombia. Theodore Roosevelt was no longer president when the agreement was signed, but he still had many friends in the Senate. He got them to reject it. After Roosevelt's death, the United States signed another agreement with Colombia. The new agreement included the payment of $25 million. It did not include the statement of regret. The Senate approved the new agreement.
The issue of America's involvement in Panama caused much bitterness in other countries of Latin America. Some did not feel safe from American interference. President Roosevelt said the United States would not interfere with any nation that kept order and paid what it owed. Roosevelt was worried because some Latin American countries were having difficulty repaying loans from European banks. He did not want the issue of non-payment used as an excuse for European countries to seize new territory in the Western Hemisphere. Roosevelt said the United States was responsible for making sure the debts were paid. His policy led to further United States involvement in Latin America. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Richard Rail and Morris Joyce. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.